Welcome to episode 12 of The Andrew Hansen Show. This week I spoke to another friend of mine and quite a different kind of entrepreneur from our previous guests, Brian David Crane. Brian is the founder of CallerSmart. It's an award-winning iOS app and website which helps users investigate mystery phone numbers. Not exactly a regular affiliate marketer. In his role as a founder, Brian has written for Inc., Huffington Post, and Tech.co about successfully building digital businesses and distributed teams. In our chat, we discussed the role of passion in business, whether it's important for your business to also be your passion. We talked about SEO in 2017, and Brian's got a wealth of knowledge there, and he shared a very cool strategy for entering a new niche and getting traffic from Google without doing the SEO work yourself. Not talking about AdWords. That was very, very important. This little chat gave some crucial insights into how people with bigger companies and higher budgets are looking at SEO. I think you'll really find that valuable. Brian told me what he thinks entrepreneurs starting out but with a low budget can do to accelerate their success. We talked about what it takes to succeed in a new business and the many ways entrepreneurship is like climbing a mountain. You'll learn what Brian means when he says you should bring more water than you think you need. We talked about the under-acknowledged difficulties of entrepreneurship and the problems with, in quotes, lifestyle businesses. The words punch in the face came up spontaneously here. I feel like I say this every time, but this was one of my favorite episodes so far. It was a combination of really thoughtful insights and advice with plenty of laughs along the way. Anyway, I hope you like it. Brian David Crane, welcome to the show.
Good to be here. Thank you, Mr. Hansen.
It's been a long time coming. I'm glad we finally made this happen.
Me too.
Hey, so first question, and this is becoming a bit of a theme for all guests. I have to ask where you are at the moment.
Right now, I am back in what's called God's country, which is the South in the U.S. I'm headed, but by the time this episode airs, I will be back in Bali, where I live.
Right. So you're in Bali, been away from there for how long is it now? Months, right?
A couple months. Yeah, I've had I left Bali and was traveling through Korea, Japan, India, Europe, and then have been back in the States for a bit for a series of conferences and to see some people.
Sounds totally normal. 9 to 5. I love it.
Yeah. So yeah. Circumnavigating. Love 21st century first world problem.
You're by the sound of it, a digital nomad, and I know that you don't like that term. Should we cover that now? No,
I could talk about what a digital nomad is. It's a term that a lot of it's a bit like entrepreneur, where people who they want to be digital nomads, so they start to call themselves that, and it's probably not accurate, the same way that somebody who says they're an entrepreneur that they might not actually be. Yeah, so for me, when I say that I'm a digital nomad, what that looks like is I spend a couple months out of the year in different locations. Last year was in Bali for the majority of the year with a group of friends, and we tend to split it up and go by quarter. So started last year in Whistler, outside of Vancouver. We had a 5-bedroom ski villa. We turned one of the rooms into a co-working space, and then left Whistler and went to Bali. I was there for the second and third quarter, and then left at the end of the third quarter for the trip I was talking about.
Okay. You think?
But I think the benefit to speak specifically about being a digital nomad that's unspoken is it's actually incredibly difficult to be traveling and trying to build a business or trying to even work. So to me, what actually, when people say they're a digital nomad, the first question I tend to ask them is like, how long are you staying in this particular location? Because there's so much time that's lost ramping up, and also time that's lost ramping down, packing up, figuring out your logistics for your next place. To me, when somebody says they're a digital nomad, I tend to think of it as like, cool, you can go be somewhere and use it as a base, like go to Hong Kong, go to, you know, certain places in Europe that are popular, and use that as a launching pad to then go out for weekend trips as opposed to trying to constantly move every week or 2 weeks. I think it's foolish.
I understand.
Yep.
I'd like to dig into that more, but I think we've got some potentially more important things to talk about. So the first thing is your business is quite different to a lot of the guests we've had on this show so far. And so I wanted you to talk, if you can, for a minute, just a little bit about Caller Smart and what you guys do and kind of how it works.
Yeah. So Caller Smart is it's a software company. We've built an award-winning iOS app and website, which helps users investigate mystery phone numbers and avoid unwanted calls and texts. What that means in layman's terms is that we help our users, especially women, be safer. So they use our software to outsmart creeps, protect one another from bad dates, phone scams, caller ID spoofing, and other dangerous situations. We basically assign a trust factor, what we call a trust factor. We assign a score to each number that's calling or texting you so that you know whether or not it's somebody you should trust.
Okay. So
and the model, sorry to interrupt you, the model is that one of we use a similar model to a company called Waze. What Waze was famous for, they were actually bought by Google a couple years ago, but what Waze was famous for was they figured out how to keep the boring world of maps up to date. And what they were able to do is they created a game on top of maps that got users to participate and, you know, tell you if the street name had changed, tell you if there were cops, tell you if there was road work, tell you if there was what the fastest route was to get from point A to point B. And they incentivized people to participate by giving them badges and some, you know, social proof and the competitive nature of folks to basically get a map or get driving directions that were better for everybody. So that was the reason that Google bought them, was they had solved this problem of keeping maps up to date. This is something that Garmin, TomTom, these big GPS companies were trying to do and very unsuccessful at it. Waze came along and changed the model. We're doing something similar when it comes to the phone book. It's another big data problem, and we have a bunch of users who compete to make sure our data in our phone book is up to date.
So it's kind of the crowdsourcing of the maintenance of this database of phone numbers.
Exactly.
I see. So how does it work? People download the app, they use it for free initially, kind of like Waze?
Yep. Yeah, it's free. It's free to use, free to, and most of our users are free users. So they use it strictly to get data out. Some of them, one of the things that we're known for is we're privacy friendly. In other words, we don't make people share access to their contacts. We don't touch your call log. We're only on iOS, and so if you want to participate and help us keep the phone book up to date, you can. There's free prizes if you do so and badges. If you don't want to, you can still get the trust factor for any number and look at who the owner of it is and what other people have said about it.
Mm-hmm. And how old is CallSmart now? You've been working on this for a while, if I remember.
Yeah, our first version of the app was launched at the beginning of 2014. So it's been, now we're on, and that was an MVP. And since that point, we've really been iterating and working to get it, to where it's at now. We're on version 7 of the app now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me one milestone that you've reached with that app and with this business that you're really pleased with.
Yeah, I mean, we cover over 600 million U.S. phone numbers, and we've got, you know, over, I think last count, 1,000 five-star reviews in the App Store. Those are organic reviews. A lot of people are, you know, coming from a marketing background, you know, people are like, oh, I got a lot of reviews. And you're like, well, how did you actually get them, or where did they come from? These are actual user reviews. And it's been featured by BuzzFeed. It's been featured by Inc., Mashable. It's something we're very proud of.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Like I said, very different to the previous guests we've had on this show. So I'm interested to dive in and kind of have a look at that business more and kind of how you came to be doing it. And actually that was what I wanted to ask you first was, I mean, you're an entrepreneur before this, you'd had businesses previously and still do, as I understand.
Yep.
I'm curious about why this opportunity or why this idea was appealing to you in the beginning. What stuck out about it? Why'd you pick that when you could have picked so many other things?
Yeah. So I spent a couple years in Silicon Valley. I worked at a company called Inflection that is in this space in people search, genealogy, big data. I spent 3 years there, and I saw this as an opportunity that they weren't particularly keen to go after. They didn't have expertise around iOS apps. So when I left Inflection, I always had in the back of my mind that I wanted to come back to this and build this in a way that that I thought could add a lot of value. And like you alluded to, I have another business called Spread Great Ideas. It's a digital marketing agency. And with Spread Great Ideas, we have a bit of a unique model. We actually invest in e-commerce brands to help them reach a much larger audience. So what that basically means is that that's like a cash flow business. And then we've used SGI or Spread Great Ideas to then fund the development of Caller Smart and also to create a disruptor business. So there is, I think for some folks who are listening in your audience where they're like, they want to build a cash flow business. You know, we built a cash flow business and then it was like, okay, what's next? Like, what are you going to use the cash flow for? Right. So the balance is one of building to me, if I had to describe it to somebody with a background in digital marketing, I would say, cool, we've created a cash flow business. And now we look at like, can you create a disruptor business while still maintaining the benefits of a cash flow or a lifestyle business, right? Like I get to travel and live where I'd like, but we're actually building, pretty impressive software that is solving a problem for a lot of people.
That's what I was curious about, actually, and I'm glad you brought it up with the way that the cash flow business connects to Caller Smart. So yeah. A lot of people listening to this podcast in my audience, they're kind of first time entrepreneurs. They're people who are starting businesses and almost exclusively cash flow businesses. They're starting a business at least in part to solve an income problem in their own yep. lives. And Caller Smart, I can see for you, is a completely different kind of business. And I'm curious, and I think people would like to hear if this business for you had less to do with generating an income, perhaps less to do with growing wealth. What was the real motivation? Why do you want to do it so much? It was obviously going to be a huge undertaking.
Well, I like the challenge of being able to solve this as a data problem, but I really think there's a story to be told, and that's part of the reason why we're doing the podcast, of using a cash flow business to then fund a disruptor business. Because what happens, my background in Silicon Valley was one of seeing people who had a business that was a disruptor business. They took on VC money and it wedded them to a particular outcome. So VCs need you, if they put money in, to have a 10 to 100x win for them, right? That's how they sprinkle their investment dollars over a period of, you know, or a group of a set of companies. And some of them have to be huge. They have to be the next Uber. They have to be the next Airbnb, because a lot of them are going to be duds. And so for me, when I was like, I want to do a disruptor business, I want to do something that I understand the background, I understand the market. I think I've never done a iOS app before. And this is not me. We have an amazing team, but like just conceptually, how to build this business. Well, I didn't want to take on VC money. And so to answer your question in a roundabout way, it's like I did it namely because I was like, I think the challenge is very interesting. I think it's something that leverages a set of skills that I already had in a market that I already knew, which is a theme that we can come back to in the podcast. But there's this theme of like, you know, grow where, to a degree, like grow where you're planted, grow where you already have a set of skills or already have an existing set of understanding of a marketplace. Mm-hmm. It's just incredibly hard. So to me, like I look at people who start a new business and I think, I'm like, does this person have any experience in this market prior to this? Because if they don't, there's just a tremendous learning curve. And Caller Smart, I already knew the market to a certain degree because of my time out in the valley.
I understand. So in part, there's this excitement for you of solving an interesting problem and leveraging an existing set of skills. But I think what I'm trying to get at here, and it's only because I know you, is that I feel like there was something a little bit more than that for you. Like the issue of privacy, for example, is something I know that's important to you. How big of a motivation was that?
Yeah, that's a great one. I mean, privacy is a big one to me.
Let me put this a different way, if you like.
I'll say this. No, well, I'll say, I mean, like, I am naturally very curious. Some people look at and think I'm investigative. Other people are like, oh, he's very curious. For me, I'm very keen on controlling my own information, what's available about me online. And so I'm sensitive to the problem that Caller Smart solves, which is people they want to have control of their own phone number in the phone book, and they want to make sure that their listing is correct. And if they don't want it to show up, so one of the pieces of tech that we've built, I think, which would speak to your question, is if somebody doesn't want their information to show up in our phone book, it's super easy to opt out. The opt-out is permanent. They claim their number. We send them a text to verify that it's theirs, or there's an automated phone call that does it. And then they've got the number that they claim that they own it, and then they're gone. They can basically take all their information out of the phone book. It's permanent, it's forever, and it's not available on the internet. And that's a differentiator for us than from what a lot of companies in our market or in our space are doing, right? I do care about privacy.
I see. Yeah. There's two reasons I asked you. One of them is because I realized I hadn't talked to you about that before, and I'm curious about the broader role that you see this business as having in your life. But this, and that's just me being nosy, I suppose. But the the second one is tied to a question that a lot of people on my audience consider and talk about, which is the role of a passion in starting a new business. There seems to be these different ways of looking at it, where some people think to have a passion in the business or the industry that you're starting something in is an advantage, and there's other people who think, well, it can tie you in a sometimes awkward way to the subject matter, to the product of your business. It can kill what passion you might have had starting out, and it can be a disadvantage. What do you think about this?
Yeah, that's a good distinction too. So the way I understood what you just said is, you look at, like, do you follow your passion, or do you do what's in your path already with passion? Is that a fair distinction?
Interesting. What is the latter? Tell me more about that.
Yeah, the latter would be, for me, Caller Smart fits into the latter, right? It was in my path, given the fact that I already knew how to build and run remote teams. I understood and knew the space. I was passionate. There is a part of me which is passionate about privacy and owning your own data and your own, your identity online. So that's a part of, like, I'm passionate about that. It's not my overarching passion in life, per se. Mm-hmm. But to me, I looked at it like, this is already in my path. I have some passion around parts of this business, so I'm gonna go after it, as opposed to, if you said to me, like, what are you super passionate about in 2017? I'd be like, well, I would love to own a semi-professional soccer team, right? Like, I love soccer. Right, it's business, but I don't know. I've never owned a soccer team. I've never, like, you know, what am I gonna do? Like, that's kind of, as an example, you know.
Right, I really like that. I've never heard that distinction before. Do what's in your path, but you can still do it with some passion.
Yeah, versus following your passion. I think following your passion, you wind up driving off a lot of cliffs. Personally,
I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Okay.
Passion is subject to change. It's very subject to change. It's you're passionate about something for a period of time. You've dealt with this, Andrew, in your own business. Is that, like, you were passionate about a topic originally, the passion fades out. Are you able to find some other passion inside of that business to keep you motivated and keep you going on it?
Yeah, you're very right. And I've also never thought about it in those terms. I think certain people's passions are lifelong. Certain people have these passions that they acquired early on and they just seem to stick. I don't know about you, I'm not one of those people. My passions do change and evolve, and sometimes new ones come in that were never there in the beginning, and so on.
So mine do as well.
Right.
Mine do as well. Like, you know, who I am now and what I'm passionate about is massively different than who I was 5 years ago and what I was passionate about, and even 10 years ago. You know, it changes. It changes.
The problems so to me, of passion.
The problems of passion. It's a to me, it's a bit of a false flag, and yeah. And what I see is people, like, from a marketing perspective, it's very easy for people on social media to be like, you should follow your passion, because of course no one's going to take the opposite position of that, right?
Like, find boring.
Exactly. Nobody's going to like that. Nobody's going to share it. So it's easy to say you should follow your passion, but it's bad advice, in my opinion. It actually should be do what's in your path with passion.
I like it a lot. Okay, so I want to go further into CallerSmart now and talk a little bit about, I suppose, marketing strategies, because that's always of interest to my listeners. So you had previous businesses that were really heavily focused on SEO, and that was a big part of your marketing world and your life, and I believe it still is. Yep. We're going to come to that later. But if I understand rightly, CallerSmart has been different. It's been different in terms of what has worked effectively, or what channels have been valuable for you in marketing. Can you tell us a little bit about that? What has been successful in terms of getting attention for CallerSmart?
Yeah, yes and no is how I would answer that question. So SEO, I love SEO. I think it's fascinating as a skill set. I think it's incredibly valuable. What's happened with CallerSmart is we've branched into like a subset of SEO, which is ASO, which stands for App Store Optimization. Similar process. You optimize your listing for keywords. You look at what people are searching for. There's actually quite a bit of volume in the App Store specifically with people searching for generic keywords where they don't actually know the app name or the brand name that they're looking for. Mm-hmm. So you can acquire customers or users or downloads through ASO, which is a form of SEO. And then for us, part of the marketing strategy is our website also drives downloads of our app. So the website ranks on mobile if you're on Safari. There's a call to action across the top to download the app. And it's a virtuous cycle, right? So the website then drives downloads of the app. The app drives more information on the website, which then ranks for more keywords. And it's designed to basically be this, like, I'm doing my hand in a big circle. I don't know what it's called, but the perpetual motion machine, I guess.
I see. And so the website is content driven, right? You're producing like informative, valuable content for people that can still rank and bring traffic.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got like a leaderboard. I mean, I was talking about the game elements. We have a leaderboard. So people who claim their number in the phone book, they then compete against other users to keep the listings up to date. We have, you know, there's one woman in particular in California who I think's made, I don't know, several thousand edits to the phone book. She's number one. But all those edits, as they happen, there is, if you go on the website and you scroll down to the bottom, you can actually see users making edits to the phone book and what it looks like. And that movement is happening inside the app primarily, but then we propagate it out to the website.
Interesting.
Yep.
Yeah, it's curious that you still, from what you've said, you found other still organic channels that turned out to be rewarding with CallerSmart, even where it's not strictly SEO. You know what I mean? Like, you didn't switch from being SEO focused to going and just doing solely paid media buys or something like that.
Correct. Yeah, it's still organic customer acquisition. It's just a slightly different channel. It'd be the same thing as if you talk to some people who do Amazon businesses, there is a whole subset of SEO that takes place with Amazon listings.
Right.
Because there's as a side note, for as far as business ventures go, I saw a stat the other day that was in 2014, 40% of all product searches were on Amazon, and by 2016 they were at 55%. That's where the search is actually starting at, right? And so that's amazing. It's an incredible stat, number one. But number two is it's incredible is the amount of volume that Amazon as a search engine is taking away from Google when it comes to products.
Right. You know? Yeah, that really is remarkable.
So. And that's SEO. To me, that's SEO in the same sense that you know, you can build, what's interesting about an Amazon listing is you can build links at it from external sources and actually get the Amazon listing to rank in Google.
Right.
That's a strong. So we're getting pretty deep into tactics, but I think it's an interesting model.
I definitely want to get deeper into the tactics. Let's talk about SEO a little further, since you're still doing so much of it with CallerSmart, and it's a part of your other businesses too.
Sure.
So, I mean, it's a cliche to say that SEO is constantly changing, that it's changed so much, that it's different now to what it was before. But I'm curious, for someone like yourself who's been involved with SEO for so long and whose relationship with it has changed and evolved, like, how do you see things with organic search at the moment in 2017? Like, what's working well? What opportunities are there? Things like that.
I think SEO has gotten. Man, that's a good question. To me, it's become much more focused on brands for high volume or high intensity, high competition keywords, mm-hmm. and so it has really created a model where you have to have a longer term view on it, because you're going to have to build a brand, in my estimation. So. And I think you and I know that that's probably not the answer you wanted to hear.
No, it actually kind of is. That's been okay. A big part of the last course that that we did in 2016 was having people, like, once upon a time I used to teach people how to make as many small affiliate sites as they could, to, and if they did their SEO right, they could rank them all. Whereas now it's much more, that is just so much more difficult to do / impossible.
Yes.
A lot of times. So
yes.
Now it's about focusing on one thing and building up as much authority as you can, and that's going to take longer in the beginning, but pay off more in the long run, which is kind of what you're saying.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. And what I see interesting that's happening as well is the market for premium domains. You're familiar with AppSumo. They bought sumo.com for $1.5 million, I think is what it was, US.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a move as well back towards very premium.com domains, because as far as all these other domains that have come out, as the registrar has made .xxx, .co, .whatever available, is if you're going to build a brand longer term, like, I think there's an art form to getting a good name to it, because you want, if in order to make it, like, people remember brands. That's where to me the market is headed.
That's interesting. It's not something I've talked to my listeners about at all. So you think, for example, when you think the advantage of building out a ton of content and a nice big platform and a strong presence in your market is made easier by having a good name?
Yeah, I do.
Mm-hmm.
I do. Yeah, I do. Yeah, I do. I think, yeah, yeah.
oddly enough, Alex and I were talking about this the other day, and he was saying he had this impression that it was easier to get links at certain times when your site looks a certain way, has a certain presence, has a certain consistency to it. And I'm sure a part of that is having a name that just looks and seems and feels like it's a big idea. This is an important authoritative site.
Is he moving in favor of brands? I mean,
yeah, big time.
Is he? Okay. Yeah. Because what's interesting as well, to go back again, if about the Amazon stuff, which I know your listeners aren't necessarily Amazon people doing products on Amazon, but one interesting thing there, and I'll say that and I'll stop, is that with Amazon Alexa, it's actually going against brands. So for instance, if you use Amazon Alexa and you say paper towels, Amazon just picks organically from Amazon search listing whatever the best item is for paper towels, unless you say Brawny paper towels, or that you want Dove hand soap, like, name a specific brand. The brands are actually losing on that platform because they're allowing Amazon to choose which brand it is. So you have this dichotomy of, you have one place which is strictly on SEO when it comes to Google. I think it's very valuable to have a recognizable domain. When it comes to Amazon, you really have to optimize for winning on a product basis, because the brands are going to be pushed away. Like, people don't don't search by brand on Amazon. They look by product.
I get it. Okay, so we talked about the value of building brands and building authority. We talked about premium domain names. And I suppose, is there anything else in the category of sort of things that you see being done badly? Things that people do with their SEO that they just shouldn't do? Or even, because I know you have so much experience with things you've done wrongly in the past that you wish you didn't did?
Well, I'll tell you one strategy that we used that was very successful. That I would say we actually did well as opposed to doing badly. And this was driven by SEO. So one of the companies that that I was involved with was called Archives.com. It was bought by Ancestry.com roughly 3 years after launch for $100 million. It was a very successful business. And the strategy with Archives.com, again, a premium domain, but the strategy there was we used PPC initially to look at keyword volume, to basically figure out what keywords organically were important to the brand. And then once we had sales volume, cost per click, cost per acquisition for those keywords, then we systematically went through in the organic listings and tried to lock up those websites either through partnerships or actually acquire those websites. And so from an SEO perspective, like if I were going to launch a brand new brand, I would use PPC as a potentially as an initial tool for being able to scout out a market. And then I would have a BD person, if it was myself or somebody else, who would basically be going through and looking at the existing sites that rank for those keywords and can we partner with them in order to get ad placements directly on the websites, or can we acquire them outright? Because to me, when I look at SEO, I still think it's very much like you pick a bad house in a good neighborhood if it's an old site for that ranks for specific terms, and then you can fix it and basically go in and rehab it like you would an old house.
I'm really glad you brought this up, because people who are too focused on SEO, they would look at that, and even if they did the first part of figuring out which parts of a market were profitable by a PPC campaign, then they would think the next step would be, okay, now we have to go out and try to rank for all those keywords. But you see that totally different. You see there's an easier, faster way to take advantage of the same thing by partnerships, by ad buys and other things.
Or even acquiring the sites, right? Because a lot of times, like what you can find downstream is, once you know what those keywords are worth to you, then you go down and look at those sites that rank, and it's as if you're now, you know, the neighborhood where you want to live in. So you drive through the neighborhood very slow. You just, you know, you're moving to Australia, so you know this. Like, you drive through the neighborhood very slow. You evaluate the houses. You get a sense of what's going on in the neighborhood. Is it safe for kids? It's the same concept with SEO, is that you drive through the neighborhood. Now you know where you want to live. You look at the different houses. You spot opportunities. And then you might see a webmaster who is still on, you know, who knows, they're still on Frontpage, let's say, it's absolutely, or Dreamweaver. They built their site in Dreamweaver, and you're like, I think I can get this site, number one, to do an ad buy, but maybe number two, to even acquire it. And it saves you orders of magnitude of time as far as getting an existing property with a decent backlink profile to rank, as opposed to trying to get a brand new site to rank out the gate for the same keyword.
Yeah, I totally get it. I think people are really going to appreciate that insight, kind of hearing how that looks from a different perspective. It's tricky for people getting started because if they don't have the resources available, they don't think of that kind of a strategy. So if they're thinking about, say, trying to minimize costs in the beginning, they don't imagine themselves being able to, say, purchase one of these websites. But even in that set of things that you've discussed, there's a range of costings there. There's a range of options for how to do that with more funds or less funds.
And I think what if you were starting out and you didn't have a lot of money, one thing that I would recommend doing is going to get onto some of these mailing lists for website business brokers. I don't know if you've talked about this in the past, but there's companies like FE International. FE International is one. There's DealFlow from Flippa. And just to start to see what is coming through as far as websites that are being sold, digital businesses that are being sold, because it starts to give you a better idea of, number one, what it would cost to buy those ones that are coming through are going to be out of most people's price range, but it also helps you to see, like, cool, how are they being valued? How are they, you can also do competitive intelligence, be like, what does this site rank for? Why do they rank so well? How did they grow so fast to go from 0 to 1 million visitors in a year, right? Mm-hmm. And start to learn some of these, some of maybe the darker arts of SEO, and also what to avoid. But it helps sharpen your own skills for evaluating a website to purchase, what you want to build for your own website, to see what's coming through the deal flow pipeline effectively. That's one thing. That's one thing I would say.
That's really cool.
And sorry to interrupt you, but one other thing is, like, when you're talking about people starting out where they worry about the cash constraints. I basically went bankrupt at 25. So I had a recycling business in high school and college. Sold it at 24, did well with the sale, was going to do a trip around the world called 25 at 25, canceled that trip, came back, lost all the money anyways from the sale of the business, and it was so healthy for me. I got my teeth kicked in, and wound up moving out to Silicon Valley and working underneath a couple people who became mentors of mine. And I think there's a real value as far as, like, if you are at a point where you don't have a lot of money, but you have a certain attitude, like you're willing to learn, look for mentors, look for people who are willing to teach you, because you can gain the skills as well as make a little bit of money on the side, right? Gain the skills as well as make a little bit of money. It doesn't have to be a binary choice.
I see. Yeah, okay. I like that. Hey, let me ask you one more technique thing before we kind of move on.
Sure.
Talking about this idea of, like, coming across sites that are in your market and thinking about the kinds of deals that you can do with them, I think people from an SEO background for one, and just a kind of like startup mentality for two, have this impression that, let's say you did this PPC campaign in this market and you got a little bit of the traffic, that any other site that was anywhere near that in terms of organic listings, other pay-per-click advertisers, whatever, they're just not going to want to have anything to do with you because you're a competitor and you're kind of in this fight. And, like, if you emailed them, if they sent back a go away, you'd be lucky. But you have had a lot of success with just reaching out and sending the sometimes obvious email to people and being able to build deals off the back of that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so you're describing, like, I have a website and it ranks for doggy bags, and I'm like, I know that I want to go after doggy bags. So I start emailing other people who already rank for terms around doggy bags in order to build links. Is that right?
I suppose I'm asking about the times where you've been able to just use outreach and just getting in contact with people to make interesting deals, whether they are of this kind, this organic kind, or otherwise.
Well, we've done all kinds of crazy stuff, right? I mean, you send them, you can send them a little gift. I think a lot to me. Well,
I've asked broadness.
Because I'm going to go on a riff.
Okay,
in a different direction.
let me just say this, and then we'll move on. All I wanted people's attention to be drawn to is the fact that there is a lot of possibilities and a lot of opportunities to be capitalized on by actually just thinking about ways that you can collaborate with people who may appear to be competitors on the surface, but that you may have some interest or some business interest aligned when you actually strike up a relationship.
Yes.
Bad questioning. Yes. Still an amateur podcast host, Brian. We'll get there. Don't worry.
I think it's an important point. No, it's an important point. What you said, and if I can add something to it, which would be, I think there's a lot of value in actually calling people. It's very easy to hide behind email. If you have a phone number for the person, a phone call, it makes it much more tangible. It's much harder to ignore. I think it's you will get a much higher response rate.
That makes perfect sense.
And it also stands out in 2017 in the 21st century. Most people don't call each other. You know, they text, they send messages. It's like we live behind the keyboard. And if you call somebody up, I've just found people are like, I never get phone calls anymore. A lot of people. Really.
I believe that.
Yeah, you call them up and be like, hey, I'm Brian. I'm calling you on behalf of this site. I just want to talk. You know, it looks like you're doing something interesting. I've got this site that's in the space as well. You know, give me a call back. I'd love to talk about working together.
Got it. As a side note, don't ever call me. I hate answering the phone. You know this about me.
True story. Well, yeah. But you also have a young family, and you're in the process of moving continents. So you have a couple ready-made excuses for why you don't like being on the phone.
Actually, you might like this. Somebody literally called me about an hour before we got on this podcast, and I looked down at the phone. Alicia was standing next to me. I looked down at the phone. I saw the person's name. It's an actual friend of mine. I actually like them, and I perhaps might have even not minded talking to them, but I just saw the phone there, and then I ignored it and kept going on with what I was doing. Hugo's having lunch. I was actually engaged in something, and I couldn't really, like, just commit, but I couldn't pick up the phone. Alicia was like, what are you doing? He's calling you. Like, I'm like, yeah, it'll be fine.
Well, but he still stood out. How many emails do you get on a daily basis?
This intended in no way to invalidate the excellent point that you're making. Listen. I want to keep going before we get bogged down in complete nonsense. So let's call that the technical part of the call. There's so many things I want to discuss with you. We have to move on from it now. Sure. So people on my list, people in my audience, like I said, most of them are starting new businesses. They're all in this situation of trying to get something new off the ground. And a lot of people, as I think just entrepreneurs in general, a lot of people end up with this feeling that kind of things are just not progressing as quickly as they would have liked, right? Like most people who start a business, it's my impression that it always comes to be more difficult than you imagined it to be while you were like writing on your dream board or whatever you were doing, right? Yep. So the thing I wanted to ask you, it's kind of a philosophical question, which I know you don't mind, is like, do you think actually anyone in the literal sense can build a business? We're going deep.
Yeah, I think it's possible. It's just very difficult. I think it's possible. It's just difficult. What the analogy that I use when it comes to building a business is that it's akin to climbing a mountain. And the reason that I like that, and I think it's for people who are starting out, I think it's something to keep in mind, is that you have a couple key things when you're building a business or when you're climbing a mountain, right? Like you have you hire a specialized guide. Somebody who knows the path, who keeps a watchful eye over you, like a mentor, not a guru, but a mentor, right? And then sometimes it's just one foot in front of the other, head down, you know, blocking and tackling is like, it's just not sexy. Like it's just
repetitive, boring.
Repetitive. Oh my God. Yeah. You're just like, you're not even looking up. You're just like, you're just stepping in front of the other. You know, and then I think there's a part to building a business where you stop every once in a while and you take a look at your progress. You know, you take a pause, you have a sip of water, whatnot, see what you've accomplished. It gives you momentum because you actually do see measurable results, but you got to look in the background to see what those results are. And that's to me, that's a discipline of like a quarterly offsite or journaling. But that's you do need to stop every once in a while and take a look at your own progress. And then I think there's another part, if I can stick with the analogy of building a business akin to climbing a mountain, of you know, you have proper tools. So you know, do you have a walking stick, good shoes, you know, compression shorts so that you're not getting jock itch, that kind of stuff. like, you know, take care of them, use them well. And it's the same thing with building a business. If you're building an online business or an offline business, right? Like your tools are they're your helpers, they're your lifeblood. And then I think there's just an attitude of like, it was Mike Tyson who said, everybody has a plan till they get punched in the face. Everybody has a plan till they get punched in the face. And you just have to learn how to handle adversity and setbacks. It's just part of it. It's like, and I think that's the unsexy part of business, is it's just gonna, It's like sometimes it's just a grind, and sometimes it's just flat out hard work, right? And then there's two other parts to the mountain analogy. So I'd say like you got to bring more water with you than you would expect. And what that is like, you know, it's the money you need to run the business, to build the business. So it's startup capital or your own money. If you're going to go climb a mountain, you bring more water than you actually think you're going to need, right? Because you don't want to get, you don't know what's coming. So you need to be able to buffer yourself from it. And then the last one is, you know, is that you protect yourself, again, climbing a mountain with like sunscreen, bug repellent, you know, a headlamp, knife, that kind of stuff. That's like contracts and lawyers. They're there to protect you in the unlikely event you need them. You know, protect you from those who would attack you. So not sexy, but also if the mosquitoes are getting after you're chewing on you, you're going to wish you had the mosquito repellent with you. If you don't have a knife, you're going to wish you had a knife. Like you need a lawyer, you need contracts, that kind of stuff. It's like climbing a mountain is like building a business in my book.
All right. Now I'm curious to see how far we can push this analogy. So if it's climbing a mountain, there's some people who, if they were plucked up off the street, are going to do a little bit better at climbing up the mountain than others. You think that's the same with business?
For sure, yeah.
So there's attitude, personality things, temperament, all this kind of thing?
Yeah, attitude is probably the biggest factor, like an attitude of, I'm willing to learn. I don't know everything. This thing is probably going to take longer than I expect. Like those
patience. You think that's important?
Patience is incredibly important. And just an attitude of like loving or appreciating work, because it's, and this is also philosophical, but like you could say, I would argue that the purpose of life is not necessarily to seek pleasure. Like you have a lot of, I just want to build this business so I can go spend time on the beach. I just want to build this business so I can, you know, optimize a particular lifestyle. And I think there's a lot of this, which is like you build the business because it gives you a set of skills that then you can go use to build another business or go do something else interesting and compelling. It's like you're always going to have more challenges and problems. And there's an attitude underlying that, which is, you're not trying to strictly optimize for pleasure. Because if you're trying to strictly optimize for pleasure and you're building a business to do that, you're going to get punched in the face. That's that's not pleasurable, and you're going to stop building it, right?
Right.
So
I just love this. It's so true. It's so true, but I laugh because it's so contrary to so much, especially modern day, and internet business advice, you know, right? Yeah. Like this narrative is so common where it's like, anybody can go out there and do it. All you have to do is believe in yourself and like you can total live the dream crap. And you can like have your laptop and work on the beach and like, and it
total crap.
You and I can make fun of this because we've actually had the laptops in the ridiculous locations and done the work. And I don't know about you, but I almost always found it completely different to the way that it was supposed to be.
Yeah, it's unfulfilling. I mean, you can be honest about it. It's not only is it completely different than the way it's supposed to be. I remember this story. This time, I'm sitting on a beach in Brazil. I'm like, I was like, oh, people are like, you got it made. You got it. And I'm watching, and we're like, not miserable, but there's kind of this like, okay, so what are we actually doing here, right? Like, what's getting you out of bed in the morning? And this one guy pulls out a smartphone, starts filming a video, and he's like, I have this amazing time on the beach in Brazil, because he was doing it to broadcast to his list.
Yeah. And
I was like, this is total crap, man. I was like, I just saw you 5 minutes before this, you know, questioning your own existence and what you're down here doing. And I'm like,
yeah.
You know, I'm like, come on, be honest with people. I mean, you gotta there's an element to it where you gotta sell the sizzle. That sure. comes at the stake, but there's also the hard truth. There's a lot of to me why Gary Vaynerchuk has been so successful, because a lot of his message is it's gonna be hard work. Like you gotta love the hard work, because it's just gonna take that. And if you're not ready for that, or you don't aspire to work hard in this, like just go do something else. You know,
right? Yeah, I always laugh about this situation. I'm sure you've had it before too, where it's like the on the upside, the the thing about having this kind of business is you can work from anywhere, and you can do it while you're traveling, and you can work with a laptop on the beach or whatever it is. But the opposite side is you will have to have your laptop at the beach.
Yep.
Like you might go on a holiday one time, and you can travel and you'll go on lots of holidays, but sometimes your laptop will have to be there next to you because you'll have something that you need to do. Like there'll be emails to reply to, there'll be some like deal that's happening or whatever. Like that,
yep.
people don't always appreciate that side of it. I think when this lifestyle of ours looks so overly glamorous and looks like, I got people in my life who think that I'm lazy, that I don't do very much work, that like he doesn't have a 9 to 5. So like, what does he actually do all day? That would be the dream. But like, there's this whole other behind the scenes area, isn't there?
Yeah, 100%. And it takes a tremendous amount of, you're right. I mean, it takes a tremendous amount of self-discipline, because if you go on that vacation and you're like, I'm not going to check email for a week, I'm not going to do write anything, touch my computer, whatever it is. Like, you have to have a tremendous amount of self-discipline to do that, because you know there's all this stuff that's waiting for you, that is calling your attention. You don't actually get to enjoy the vacation or sit on the beach like what you're talking about. Versus if you're an employee, you go, cool, I'm taking my vacation for the week. Like, they literally check out, right? They're like, it's in their contract that it's done with, and they're off the grid. I'm like, to me, sometimes I see these people, I go, that's actually pretty nice, right? Like, they know nobody's getting a hold of them. Their house could be burning down. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, they are off the grid. And this is something, you know, living in Bali, I would be there and I'd see these Europeans come through, and they have awesome vacations. Like, when they're in their vacation mode, it doesn't matter what's going on back in Europe. Like, they're not doing anything, and they're employees, right? They got their 3 weeks in the summer. They're not internet entrepreneurs. The people who are the internet entrepreneurs are like, I'm taking pictures of how amazing this workstation is, but I'm also cranking away because, like, I gotta be able to tell people how amazing this workstation is, right? That I'm working from.
Right.
So it's a paradox, man.
Yeah, that's very weird. So we're not convincing anyone to want to build a business online here. So we should think more about that just for a second.
No, I think let me say this. The beauty of building an online business is it gives you the freedom. It gives you the freedom to then have those choices. And then it's up to you. Creates a lot of responsibility. But along with the freedom comes the responsibility, because you create this freedom for yourself to be on the beach, to go on amazing trips, to do whatever you'd like to do. And then you have a responsibility to be like, so what is it? Like, am I going to be on the computer 24/7? Am I going to take an actual vacation? Like, you have a responsibility to then make the choice.
Hmm. Yeah, I know what you mean. Okay, so let's flip the coin then. Tell me if you can, something about entrepreneurship that perhaps only after a certain length of a career at it, you've found surprisingly enjoyable, something that is not part of the publicly sold dream, something that's not sexy, but that you've come to find very pleasurable.
I have found the creative process to be, I'm sorry, there's a phone going off in the background. I've found the creative process to be incredibly enjoyable. And what I mean by that is the act of creating and seeing something come to fruition that was only an idea a period ago. So whether it's creating wireframes and seeing an app come to life, whether it's a website, like driving the design of it, the creative process, I think, as an entrepreneur, is incredibly it's incredibly enjoyable if you like the product what you're working on. Because what winds up happening is you create functional art, which to me is super cool. Like, you create something, you go, you know, instead of going to a museum and looking at a painting on the wall, you're like, oh, that's nice. You know, it touches you maybe in some way. But if you actually, like, UX and building stuff and building tech, like, people touch it and use it and break it all the time. And it's your creation, and you get to refine it, make it better. I find that incredibly rewarding.
That's interesting to me, because that's the kind of pleasure that's detached at least a little bit from a specific outcome. That's not the kind of pleasure where it only comes about if you achieve this particular thing in the business. You're talking about a process here a little bit more than an outcome. Is that right?
Yeah, very much the creative process. Yeah. because the outcome of it, to a certain degree, the outcome, you divorce, to me, I divorce myself from the outcome, be like, I did my best with this. We can always come back and tweak it to make it better, but the act of being like, number one, of understanding the psychology of why someone would click a button or press here or do what you either want them to do or not do, and then number two is like trying to create a solution that they find pleasurable, that they want to use over and over again, right? That's like, I find it number one, I find it fascinating, but number two is that, like, just even doing it, you become, to me, I think you tap into something that is you create beauty in the world, in a sense, right? It's not this abstract concept. It's you actually can create something beautiful that I think is the value really in human life, honestly, if you want to get really philosophical.
Oh, you're tempting me. No, we could really. Yeah, I like that. That's really cool. That's something that I would like to see discussed more in the world of entrepreneurship, is those other kinds of motivations, those other, like, more subtle, more, oh, I hesitate, but even more real sorts of small joys.
Yeah, because do you care about the people that you're building something for, right? And that's a lot of what I see in internet marketing to a certain degree, is they're like, it's just this, it's like a very impersonal, it's just an email address or it's just another sale or whatnot. Be like, there's a person on the other side of that, right? And did they get what they expected? Are they happy with the product? Can you make it better for them? That is part of the creative process, right? You can get feedback from it. It's a fascinating time to be alive. You can build something. It can be artistic. You can find out from people if they like it, and you can come back and tweak it and make it better. It's a cool time.
It really is. It's a cool time.
You know, so, and it's exciting. Like, I do love that about entrepreneurship, because you are in one sense very much you're like a god. You create the world, your own little corner of the world, in the way that you would like it arranged and ordered.
I don't know how I feel about you being God.
Well, you're a god too.
you're a bigger god.
We're not having a pissing contest.
All right, Brian. Let me ask you this, and this might be our last question, depending on how we go for time. But I'm curious about this with everyone, but it struck me that I might be most interested in what you have to say about this one. So you're the kind of person, you're not a startup entrepreneur now. You've had various businesses, many with great success over an extended period of time. I mean, success financially. You now in your circles are well respected. You've got freedom. You travel around. You've got means. You don't have these limitations that a lot of people have. What do you want now? That's what I'm interested in. What are you working towards? Right? Like, what you talked a little bit about the creative freedom stuff and just the pleasure of that, and that's cool. But I'm wondering what else there is in that kind of world. Like, what are you moving towards in the years to come?
Like, what's important? What does success look like for me?
Do you want more of that you don't have now?
Well, I want the life that you have. And what I mean by that is, I want to meet somebody that I want to spend my life with and start a family.
Okay.
You know, that's the next chapter of my life that I want to get into personally.
And how do you see business as being connected to that?
So the business gives the freedom and the flexibility to go where I think I have the highest odds or likelihood of meeting that sort of woman. And then also having the freedom and the flexibility to follow that path wherever it does go. So for instance, like, if you say, I think that the public education system to a large degree is has some serious flaws with it. I think as an entrepreneur, you can try to change the public education system. That's what a lot of people spend their time doing, but you can also homeschool, right? Or you can take an alternative route for your kids when it comes to education. So when you can live where you'd like to live, is she going to be from the US? Probably not. Is she going to like have come from another country? And like, do we get to go spend 3 months of the year there? Like, you then have that freedom and that flexibility. So for me, like, what does success look like, or what's important to me? The next chapter is going to be finding a partner and starting a family.
And
business funds that in the sense that it then gives me the, like, number one, it gives me the time freedom to spend time with her, and then number two is that, like, we can go co-create or go wherever we would like to create that life. Now the downside to that is that, like, if you don't have to be anywhere, it creates this tremendous paradox of choice, you know.
Big time.
Huge time. You know this. Because so you did the traveling thing with Alicia for a period of time, right? And at the end of it, like, we're going to come actually set our roots down in London.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even that was only good for a period of time. As you know, we're about to move again, but that's another problem of the paradox of choice, is that we never stop thinking, wait, is there somewhere else that we should live that would be more optimal for our complete happiness?
I know. That's part of the human equation, though, I think. I think that's part of the human equation to a certain degree. Like, you just don't, you can diminish that to a degree. There's some tools and tactics to be able to do so, but to a large, like, that questioning is, I think it's also what gets us up and out of the bed in the morning.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. So is there an email address that you would like to give to any kind of women who are listening who get the sense that I can, like, leave it as a link below the video? I don't know, anything you like. It just seems like an obvious next question. You don't have to answer that. If you
could put my work email in there, which is brian@collarsmart.com.
Amazing. Mate, this has been so much fun. I really appreciate you making the time for this.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this since I heard about your podcast. I have to say that the way you describe it on iTunes, I laughed out loud. Like, I think I read it 2 or 3 times, just laughed out loud. So
now, having been on it, do you feel as though it was accurate?
I do. I think you nail your sense of humor and also where you're going with the podcast. So I'm honored and pleased to have been a guest, really.
That was Brian saying, if you are listening to this and you haven't subscribed to the podcast on iTunes, you really should do that now. There's a link below the thing that you're listening to. Just do it. Don't be silly.
And you need to also go leave a 5-star review in iTunes.
Boom. Yeah. Heard it there.
Yep. You need to go do that. All right.
Thanks again, mate. Let's do it again, huh?
Sounds great. Looking forward to the next time. Thanks, Andrew. All right.